Let me see what you see and feel what you feel when you look at Jesus' humility. Let this congregation see what you see. Let us feel what you feel about the magnificence of Jesus and his humility. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, this morning I want to talk about the humility of God, not just God the Son, but God the Father and the Spirit. It is a most remarkable reality that the Most High God, who has all power, is also the most humble. I want to look at the magnificence of Jesus related to his humility. Now, all the religions of the world have different views of God, but none of them have a God that's humble. This is a surprising revelation in terms of the religious history of the nations, that our God is not only powerful and loving, but he's profound in his humility. Now, as we understand his humility, it has a tremendous impact upon our heart. It's not just an interesting topic. It moves us deeply. And the object of what I want to focus on in this message is the humility of God and how it moves us to love him and to admire him. Admire sounds like a soft word. It's bigger than admire. But just filled with admiration, Jesus, I trust you. I have gratitude towards you, towards your leadership. I trust your leadership. But not only that, it produces confidence in our heart to relate to him, because he's so easy to relate to. He's not grouchy and quick to anger. He's so opposite of that. He loves us, but more than that, or in addition to that, he's so humble in his approach towards us. And then thirdly, we find inspiration. It's not my focus in this message, us imitating humility, walking it out, but that's an inevitable impact. When we see his, when I see it, I say, Lord, I want to be like that. I admire you so much. I have confidence to draw near to you, but I want to be like you. Now, love and humility, they are like twin virtues. There can be some distinctions between them if you want to get real specific, but really they're expressed together, they're two sides of one coin. Matthew chapter 11, Jesus said, take my yoke, learn from me, because I'm humble. He says lowly of heart, but the other translations say humble or meek. Now this is the only character trait that Jesus ever identified about himself. I mean, he is wise, but he never said, I am wise. He's holy. He's loving, but he never said, I am holy. The only character trait he proclaimed about himself, I'm humble. And then he gave us an exhortation with a promise. He said, learn from me. Now, when he called us to learn about his humility, he was in that exhortation promising to teach us if we wanted to learn. He was saying, I will teach you. Now, not only that we would imitate it, of course, that's in focus here in this verse, that we would imitate the humility, but that we would admire it, that we would see him and go, wow, who you really are. I mean, who is this man that loves us so much? Now, Jesus has every reason to be proud. That's the remarkable thing. The most humble man has the most reasons to be proud. I mean, think about his accomplishments. We start with Genesis chapter 1. He created the heavens and the earth. I mean, to have Genesis 1 on your resume, I mean, my, the accomplishments, his destiny. Revelation 5, we looked at it in one of the sessions. He's going to govern the earth. World dominion is his for sure. I'm talking about openly seen by all the nations. That's his destiny. To rule every sphere of the earth. His relationship with the Father. No man has ever been so close to the Father as Jesus. I mean, his accomplishments, his destiny, his intimacy with the Father. He had every reason to be proud, but he's the most humble. I mean, when we accomplish something little like a $1 billion business or a worldwide ministry, we get tempted with pride. Men do. Jesus's accomplishments are so much greater, and he's unmoved in terms of pride. No pride has ever touched his soul. Now, the good thing about humility is everybody can have it. It's the ultimate definition from God's point of view of greatness. It's the ultimate, it's the premier definition, standard for greatness. And everybody can have it. You can have no gifts, no abilities, no education, no money, everything going bad, and still grow in humility and walk in greatness before God. It's remarkable. Paragraph C. Now, Jesus, he did not just put on humility to accomplish a task. It's not like he was at the Father's right hand and the Father said, "Son, you must go down to the earth, become a man." He takes a deep breath, comes to the earth, walks out his task for 33 years, goes back to heaven and says, "Wow, that was intense. What an intense season of humility." Then he takes off the garment of humility, lays it aside, and goes, "Never again do I want to go through something that intense." That's not what he did. Humility is not a task that he accomplished, an assignment, but it's his eternal nature. It's who he is in his heart from eternity past. It's what he enjoys. He actually enjoys humility. He's existed eternally in the form of God as a servant with humility. Now, we know that when he took upon himself the form of man, he walked in humility. But what might be new to some people is that even in the form of God, he had the same level of humility. It was not expressed for the people in the earth to see it, but it existed. The very fountain of humility is in his being. Matthew chapter 20, verse 28. He says, "The Son of Man did not come to be served, but he came to serve." Now, this is interesting because this phrase, "the Son of Man," very important phrase. It points back to the famous prophecy in Daniel 7, verse 13 and 14. It's the Son of Man prophecy. It's only one prophecy in the Old Testament, Daniel 7, and it's the prophecy Jesus referred to more than any other prophecy in the whole Bible was that one famous Son of Man prophecy. It's the one where the Messiah as a man is promised the dominion of the world. And again, this is the title Jesus referred to the most. Therefore, it's the prophecy he referred to the most. He called himself the Son of Man, saying, "I'm the Daniel 7 guy. I'm the man talked about in Daniel 7. That's the only time that phrase was ever used in the Old Testament about God. In other words, when Jesus was talking about his promise of world dominion as a man, he said, "You have to understand, as the one that will lead all the nations of the earth, I will do it with an attitude of service. I came to serve, and even as the Son of Man, I will be a servant forever." Now, he tied world dominion together with humility. He said in Matthew 5:5, "The meek, the humble, will inherit the earth." Jesus, the most humble, will have the greatest leadership of the earth. But he said, anybody that will be humble like me, you can share the government of the earth with me in the age to come. Now, the greatest, he pronounced it. He gave us insight into his value system and into the economy of the kingdom. He said, the greatest will always be those that were most humble. Now, Jesus, we know, is and will forever be the greatest man. That means he will always be the most humble man, even in the age to come. There will be none like him that will surpass his humility. John chapter 13. the well-known account in the upper room where Jesus took off his robe, girded himself with a towel, and he washed the feet of his disciples. This is a most remarkable revelation of his heart. He takes his robe off, girds himself with a towel, kneels down, washes the dirty feet of the broken men that are his disciples. Now, he did it as an example, but more than an example. It was more than just an example for men to follow. It was an expression of his core identity. It's who he is in time and eternity. Jesus has the robe of dignity. He's King of Kings, and on that robe, it says his title, King of Kings. He has the title of royalty. But beloved, beneath that robe forever is that same man with a towel girded around his waist. He revealed to the disciples, though they could not understand it in that moment, he revealed the kneeling God. The God who kneels in servanthood to wash the dirty feet of broken people and delights in it. He was fully at home washing the disciples' feet. He was not in any way untrue to who he is forever as God when he did that. Now the world religions, they all seek a God with power. But Jesus revealed the God that kneels to serve and who delights in it. Now, he is the God of power, but that's not the whole story. We will never understand the truth about his glory unless we see the kneeling God with a servant heart. We need that facet of his character to understand his power in the right way. For nobody has power and humility combined together like this man does. Fully God, fully man. Well, lest you think it was just a one-time example at his first coming, Luke chapter 12, he describes himself at his second coming. He gives the parable, talking about himself, calling himself the master. He said, blessed are the servants whom the master, when he comes, reference his second coming, he will find his servants watching. But here's the remarkable declaration. This is Jesus at the second coming, describing himself at the second coming. He said, he will gird himself. He will have them sit down, and he will come and he will serve them. Now, what? Jesus serve his people? Surely his people serve him. Both of them are true. But beloved, as we serve him now and forever, be sure of this. We will never serve him more than he serves us. Never. We will never have more humility. We will never give more to him than he gives to us. Never. He will outgive us. He will outserve us. He will have more humility forever than any other man. This is the one we love so much. Again, the word admiration, that seems like a weak word, but I admire him. I trust him. I'm so grateful for who he is. I want to be near you. I want to be like you. That's the cry that I feel when, in my heart as I see these truths. And I only see them so dimly, but the little that I see, I just want more of it. Holy Spirit, let me see what you see and feel what you feel when you gaze on the humility of Jesus. Well, at the second coming as well, we find another description in Psalm 45. Verse 4, this is in context describing Jesus and his victory over all the powers of darkness when he comes back to the earth in majesty in a display of power never seen before in history. He utterly defeats all of his enemies that have rose up against him throughout history. Absolute defeat. No enemy survives this victorious, conquering time where Jesus returns. But look at this. When he comes forth in his majesty, his great display of power. When he comes forth in victory, he triumphs over every enemy. Everybody loses. He wins everything. Everyone who opposed him, I mean. But look what it says. He did this on behalf of humility, which means he acted from humility. Everything he did in his power, he did in perfect humility. There wasn't a trace of pride in his being when he has the ultimate victory before all the nations. No trace of pride. He did it from humility. But not only that, he did it for humility to produce humility in the nations. And as the nations observe this, talking about on into the millennial kingdom, those nations that will continue in the natural, they will be overwhelmed at his power and the way that he carried his power and administrated it with perfect humility. It will actually be used to produce humility in the nations. Now, what humility or meekness is, a real simple definition, meekness is power under control. Meekness is not weakness. Meekness is when power is perfectly restrained so that it serves its rightful purpose. The word meekness is often used related to a horse. When a horse is being trained, when a horse is broken of its wildness, and all of its strength is harnessed and brought under perfect control so its strength can be maximized, the horse is called meek. Not weak, but everything brought under focus and control. Jesus uses his power in perfect meekness. He only uses it to produce humility and love and righteousness, to fill the earth with truth. Never ever to show forth pride in any way. Paragraph H. God is so attracted to humility. I want to add a verse here. 1 Peter 3 verse 4. Where Peter describes God's view of humility. Of how attractive it is to God. Here's what Peter says. That humility, or a quiet and gentle spirit. It's the idea of humility clearly. It has an incorruptible beauty in God's eyes. It is very precious. The reason it's so beautiful and so precious to him, because it is the very description of the heart of God as seen in the face of Jesus. Let's look at page 2. Look at Philippians chapter 2. This is, I believe, the premier passage in the New Testament on the humility of God. Philippians 2 verse 6 to 9 lays it out so clearly. There's other very important passages on God's humility, but none that surpasses these few verses right here. It's the humility of God seen in the incarnation. Now, when I say the humility of God, not just the humility of Jesus. Jesus is fully God and will be God forever. But when Jesus became man, he was not only expressing his own humility, he was telling the Father's story as well. He was telling us what the Father's like, as well as displaying his own humility. Well, it's in context to the incarnation. The incarnation, most of you are aware, means when Jesus became a human. When Jesus became a man, when he was incarnate. At that time, he had two natures. God the Father only has one nature, the nature of God. Jesus is the only one in existence with two natures, fully God, fully man. And he will be fully God and fully man forever. so remarkable, a billion years from now, he will still be a Jewish man a billion years from now. He will never, ever take off the garments of humanity and lay them aside. He will always be human. That was part of how it worked. Now, the incarnation is a great mystery. How it is that Jesus could be fully God and fully man at the same time with no contradiction, nobody can fully grasp this mystery. Paul says it, 1 Timothy 3:16. He goes, without any controversy. He goes, there's no debate about it. He goes, let there be no debate about this. The mystery of godliness is great. It's a great mystery. We can't contain it in our understanding in this age. We can see hints of it. We can understand some of the broad strokes principles, but we can't resolve all the tensions that are involved in this great mystery. The great mystery of godliness. And Paul goes on and says, here it is, God in the flesh. Now, God in the flesh, that's a difficult concept. As God, Jesus has infinite abilities. As man in the flesh, he has finite abilities. So which is it? Does he have infinite or finite? How does it work? Well, as God, he knows everything. As a man, as a child, he's learning and growing in wisdom. How can one who is God grow in wisdom? Well, as God, he knows everything. As a man, he grows in wisdom. As God, he has all power. As a man, he became tired and had to sleep and became hungry. As God, by the Spirit, he can be everywhere at the same time. His presence is everywhere. As a man, he's contained and restricted to be at one place with a physical body at one time. Which is it? Is he here or is he not here? Does he know or does he not know? Jesus on the earth, what a mystery. But the mystery takes a whole nother dimension. When the next phrase, he's justified in the Spirit, or he's vindicated in the Spirit, is what some translations say. In other words, God in the flesh is one mystery when he walks on the earth for 33 years. Now, God in the flesh is in heaven with a resurrected body. In the resurrection, that's a whole other set of mysteries. How does it work? Is he really a man or sort of a man? Is he everywhere or is he just one place? Does he still have a physical body? Yes. Well, with the physical body, how does it work? Well, Paul said, as a mature apostle, I'm still baffled by it. It's a great mystery. I've read on this topic over the years. It's a very engaging, challenging topic. And some theologians have what I will call an inappropriate confidence in their intellectual ability to grasp this. It's called pride. I've read some and they land all the issues. There's no tensions. They get it. I doubt it. Paul said, great is the mystery. When you encounter a burning bush, it's better to bow before and worship and not to pretend to comprehend all the properties of that bush. It's better to bow and to say, you're God. Let's leave things alone. Let's let the tensions remain unresolved. That's just a little short exhortation for those that presume to land all the details and argue and fight and debate about how much they know. We're talking about the great mystery of the God-man. There's no greater mystery before the human mind. Combine that together with the three-in-one triune God in the Trinity. Three persons in one Godhead. Perfect unity. yet with distinctions, the great mysteries of God. Paragraph B. Now let's look at this passage. Philippians chapter 2. Just verse 6 to 8. We'll just look at these three verses. Jesus, this is verse 6, who being in the form of God, he did not consider it robbery to be equal to God. Verse 7, but he made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant, coming in the likeness of man. Verse 8, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death. There are so many key phrases. You could write a book on each one of them. There's so many key phrases in this one short passage. Let's go through it again and just highlight one or two points. This is a mountain that you could climb your entire life and never get to the top of. Even in the age to come, we will be learning these truths, the depths of them. Verse 6, he's in the form of God, which means, this includes this idea, all the power and the privilege of being God belongs to Jesus. Jesus is as much God as the Father is. He's the uncreated God like his Father and like the Spirit. So in the form of God, all the honor, all the privilege, the power of deity is rightfully his. But there's one problem. If he's going to redeem humans, he has to become human, because God can't save humans. A human has to save humans. I'm talking about saving the sense of becoming the offering, the sacrifice, the payment for their sin. So God looked at his son and says, you have to be human to save humans. To be the human high priest, you have to be one, and you have to be human forever. That means when I send you there to the earth, God so loved the world that he sent his only son. He goes, you can't walk in all the privileges and power that you've enjoyed forever. So Jesus, he did not consider it robbery. Now, the word robbery is a difficult word to work through. The King James and New King James use that word. Almost all the other translations use the word. He didn't consider those privileges something that he should grasp and hold on to and clutch to. I don't know really why the King James uses the word robbery. Most commentators agree that's not the best translation. So I'm going to use the more common translation, that though Jesus dwelt in the form of God with all the privileges of deity, he didn't clutch, grasp, hold on to forcibly these privileges. Because he couldn't and become a man and become the offering for our sin. He laid them aside. He didn't cease to be God, but he said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to live within the confinement of humanity to save humans. What an amazing decision that he made. Remarkable. He said, I'm not going to hang on to my rightful privileges as God. I'm going to go to the earth. I'm going to bear being tired, hungry. I'm going to be misunderstood. I'm going to have limitations I've never known before. But I'll do this. Look at paragraph C, verse 1. Paragraph 1 under it. He did not insist on his rights to live free from rejection and pain and humiliation. Can you imagine? The uncreated God of Genesis 1 is going to feel pain and be rejected. The one that's worshipped by angels is going to be written off by puny men on the earth. He's going to bear humiliation. It's remarkable. How could one who created the heavens and earth ever be hungry, ever be tired? But he said, yes, I'll do that. That's the price that I pay, that I could win them and they would be mine forever in relationship. I'll do it. But the point I'm making isn't just how extreme it is. The point I'm making is this is the quality of his humility from eternity past. This is the nature of what his heart is like. This wasn't a decision that he had to psych up for, so to kind of really get ready for, to act contrary to what he was used to, but he actually walked out the reality of how he always was a servant with humility. Number two, in denying himself these privileges, he wasn't denying his true identity as God. He didn't lay aside his deity. He laid aside the privileges and the power to operate as God. But he says, I'm still God, but I'm still true to my nature of God, because God is humble forever. God is most humble. Paragraph D. He didn't insist on being honored. He did not insist on being understood. But he emptied himself of his reputation in the eyes of men. But the point I'm making is that this was not a challenge for him, not this part. He goes, I can do humility. It's who I am at the core of my being. This is not a garment that's foreign to me. Can you imagine? He embraced a lifestyle where everybody underestimated him. Everybody did, every time. Everyone underestimated him, not once or twice. Here he is, the 20-year-old young man in the carpenter shop. Makes a beautiful table. The lady says, young man, what a beautiful table. He created the trees that produce the wood for the table. She has no idea who he is. She appreciated the table. She has no idea he created the earth. He's underestimated by everyone all the time. Even Mary, who knows most about him, and John, his beloved apostle, when he shows John his glory in the book of Revelation, John falls like a dead man. I didn't really understand who you are. No one knew how superior his abilities were. He concealed them. When they saw him, they saw nothing that was unusual or nothing distinct. He was just a delightful young man who worked in the carpenter shop, who was kind to people. Had a lot of potential. I mean, if he really stayed with it, he might have 3 or 4 carpenter shops one day in Nazareth on each corner of town. Really make a name for himself. But he was content to be seen as an ordinary man. I mean, he has Genesis 1 accomplishments in his past. He has world dominion as his destiny in the future, but nobody even knows a hint of that, hardly. I mean, his mother does. The apostles begin to catch on, but they don't understand the fullness. But the problem is, he's not troubled by that. He's not enduring this humiliation. Only if they knew he was as comfortable with concealing as he is with revealing, because humility is where his heart is forever. This is the man that's going to rule the earth before all the nations. Isaiah 53, he has no form or comeliness. He had no form, no particular status in society. No comeliness, no unusual attractiveness where he stuck out as head of the class. Most likely to succeed, voted, unanimous. No, he didn't win that. Paragraph E, think of the analogy. If you were the most wealthy person in the earth, and you never used your wealth ever on yourself, ever. But worse than that, you never let anybody know you had the wealth. Ugh. I mean, if you have power, whether financial or social or whatever position, if you have power, even the most humble one is kind of whispered a little bit, you know. Yes, I could buy that for you. Oops, Not supposed to say that, but I probably could. Hint, hint, hint. You could? Well, how could you afford that? Well, oops, I shouldn't have said that. The reason that we like people to know, because it changes the way they relate to us. People know you have wealth or power or influence, they relate to you different. Jesus said, I don't need them to relate to me on that basis. I am content to walk as a servant, content to live in humility. Instead of being known as the powerful, influential one in Nazareth. Let's go top of page 3. Paragraph G, as a weak, limited human being. I mean, in the sense all human beings are compared to God. As a weak man, in that sense, with limitations, he is expressing the glory of his Father's personality. His display of the Father's glory was not put on hold because of his limitations as man. As a man, but in his meekness, he was telling the nations what God the Father was like at the heart level. Now, the nations didn't catch the message, but Jesus was displaying it. He didn't lose his identity as God by becoming a person, but rather he was expressing the truth about about what the nature of God is. He was expressing the truth about God, not concealing God, by showing his meekness and his restraint. John 17, verse 24, one of my favorite prayers of Jesus. He's praying to the Father. Father, I desire that they whom you gave me, they would be with me where I am. Jesus asked the Father, I want them with me forever. I want them with me. That's why I'm offering myself for them. I want them with me. My question is, why? Honestly, I've thought of this. Many times I go, Lord, the first commandment is that we would love you with all of our heart. That's what you want most. You're God. You have all power. What do you want most? That humans would love me with all your heart. Why? You're so powerful. You're so interesting. We're so broken. We're so boring. Why do you care if we love you? I don't get it. What do we give you by loving you? How are you stronger? How are you enriched? Because weak, broken people love you. Why is this so big on your agenda? It's number one. Beloved, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. It's a revelation of his humility, the value that he esteems in our lives. I mean, it's remarkable. He doesn't just want us to be with him. Revelation 3, he wants to share the government of the nations with us. I mean the undeserving ones. None of us deserve salvation. How much less do we deserve sharing the government of the earth in the age to come? Why would he want to share it with us? Revelation 3:21, he goes, you'll sit on the throne with me. I'll share my government, my inheritance with you. Well, the Father has a plan from ages past. His plan is most remarkable. No religion of the world could ever think of such a plan. The Father conceives this plan in his heart, determines it. He's going to create a natural realm because ages past there was only the heavenly realm. The angels might have said, what's a natural realm? What's an earth? You'll see. Then I'm going to govern the earth with humans. What's a human? The angels might have asked. You'll see. And for billions of years, humans who voluntarily choose humility and love will be connected to my Son. I will join the heavenly realm and the earthly realm together on the earth, and then I will tabernacle with man on the earth. I will put my throne on the earth in the midst of multitudes of humans who are dwelling in love and humility in a voluntary way, and love will never be diminished on the planet ever again. Never. That's my plan. Wow. So Father's going to have heavenly realm, earthly realm. They're going to come together. He's going to put his throne on the earth, and the earth is going to be governed, and love will be sustained and maintained as multitudes of weak and broken people are saved, redeemed. They voluntarily choose love and humility in a way that never diminishes. Do you know in the age to come, we will not be robotic. We will not be automated to love. I have resurrection body. I love you. Anything you want, Master. That's not what it's going to be like. We will not be automated. Yes, with a resurrected body, there'll be no sin. But remember this. The angels did not have sin before they rebelled. What will keep humans from rebelling? The angels were not created with sin, yet they rebelled against God. The humility and the love of God openly revealed will produce such gratitude, and the people of God will so trust and admire Jesus that they will respond in a voluntary humility forever. Yes, they have a resurrected body, but there's a humility and a gratitude they will say yes to that will never be diminished. The Father's working on a master plan where his humility is made known to the nations. But that's not the end of the plan. The revelation of his love and humility will have an impact, and people will actually choose humility as a voluntary choice that will be sustained forever with the power of the resurrection in their bodies, in a resurrected body. It's remarkable. The power of God does not produce humility. People think, well, if God revealed his power, everyone would be humble. Well, God showed his power in the nation of Israel when he delivered them from Egypt. 10 plagues of Egypt. Divided the Red Sea. Brought them to a mountain. Was set on fire by the glory of God. I mean, the nation shook, but in a short period of time, they rebelled against God. Power doesn't produce humility. Humility produces humility. But the master plan is an eternal earth that never diminishes in love. And the people have a voluntary choice throughout eternity. I was going to say to the end, there is no end. How could God produce this? So much so that his throne would be on the earth in the midst of them. Well, again, he doesn't automate his people in the resurrection. He wins them entirely. But again, power's not enough to win a heart to humility. History has proven that. The angels fell. They saw the power of God. Adam was in the garden, the power of God he sinned. And the nation of Israel out of Egypt, they all said no to God and they saw power. Power's not enough. Paragraph J. The revelation of his glory includes seeing one who's so high, who went so low, to bring us so near, because we are so dear to him. There's many facets of his glory, not just his power. His power is not enough. His transcendence, his infinite superiority is not the whole story. His infinite humility is another facet with his infinite power. But that's not even the whole story. There's more. He brings us so near. He cares so much. He doesn't want to reign separate from us, but in deep, interactive partnership with us forever over the earth in government. Why? Do you want this? Well, because he is love. Because he is humility. Only humility would conceive of such a plan. Let's look at paragraph N. The bottom of page 3. Jesus is not out just to prove a point of how powerful he is. He's out to win our hearts. He's out to produce humility in his people forever. That's the master plan. To show power, to show love, to show wisdom, show humility, and end up with an earth that never diminishes in love and righteousness, so much so the Father's throne dwells on the earth forever. He tabernacles with God, well, God tabernacles with men on the earth. He didn't come as the God of jasper-like glory. I mean, God has diamond-like, which would be the ancient jasper, diamond-like glory in his being. Jesus could have come as the jasper-like God and just wowed and dazzled the nations, but he came in a display of humility. Yes, we need the jasper-like glory. That dimension's critical, but it's not enough by itself. There's a bigger picture of what God's after. Dwelling with his people in deep partnership forever, never diminished, all of it in voluntary responses of love, because love that's automated, that's robotic, is not love. He doesn't want a programmed workforce. He wants a deeply moved bride that's an eternal partner. Top of page 4. God can dazzle us with power, but he can't have relationship with us except humility is in the expression of his personality. Takes the humility part. Power's not enough. Humility's not enough. It takes power. It takes the whole, it takes wisdom. The whole thing together is what produces this dynamic eternal relationship together on the earth. Isaiah 49. We'll just look at this for a moment. This is one of the grand prophecies of Jesus in the Old Testament, where Isaiah has this very unique experience of he eavesdrops, so to speak, upon a dialogue between the Father and the Son in heaven. By the Holy Spirit, he gets to overhear a conversation. I don't know how that works. But the Holy Spirit shows this to Isaiah. So he records the dialogue. And this record shows us the depth of Jesus' humility. Now Isaiah lived 700 years before Jesus became a man. So this is a long time ahead of before Jesus would come as the Messiah. It starts off, the first 4 verses of Isaiah 49 are about Jesus at his first coming. And then the rest of the chapter are the dynamics of Jesus related to his second coming. But it starts off, we'll just jump right into the middle of the dialogue. You can read it more on your own. Jesus is speaking, and he makes a very surprising statement to Isaiah, undoubtedly. He says, "The Father is going to hide me under the shadow of his hand." Isaiah goes, why would the Messiah be hidden? Why wouldn't the Messiah appear stage 1 in full glory? The Messiah is going to show up on the earth hidden. And then Jesus says it a second time. He's talking to the Father. He will hide me. He will not fully unveil my glory. Actually, not just 33 years of Jesus on the earth is he hidden. Then 2,000 years of church history. In addition, Jesus is mostly hidden. And then at the second coming, the Father lifts his hands and the nations see the grandeur, the glory of this man. He is unveiled. He's no longer concealed. So Jesus in verse 4 makes a statement, a positive statement. First a negative statement, then a positive statement about what was happening in this time of being hidden. And we see the depth of his humility and we admire him so much because he did this to accomplish our salvation that we could be with him forever. But again, this humility is always what was in his heart. He starts off, he gives us the esteem or the view that men had about him. He said, I've labored in vain. I spent my strength for nothing. Yet surely my reward is with the Lord. I will be glorious in his eyes. He starts off negative, he ends positive. Which is it? He's saying from man's point of view, I labored for 33 years. I achieved nothing. Nothing notable. 3.5 years of ministry. Things seem to go well. He ends up with 120 people following him in the prayer room at the end. That's it. Men looked at him. He didn't achieve anything notable in their eyes. He didn't achieve anything that men would celebrate. Here he is in his 20s. This young man has a good future in business. Maybe he will be mayor of the town one day. He's so got such people skills. People like him. They're attracted to him. Suddenly quits the family business. Goes into preaching. Crowds are enormous. They think, wow. Well, he gets a little carried away. And suddenly they kill him. He's only 33. Nobody's following him. Everybody left him. Poor guy. That's how men saw Jesus. We're talking about the Most High God dwelling on the earth. That's how it ended stage one. Jesus now gives his view. I was glorious in the eyes of God. Paragraph B, Matthew 3:17. Before Jesus preached one sermon. This is before his ministry started. The Father bends over the balcony of heaven. He says, my beloved, I am so well pleased with you. Well, Father, I haven't even preached a sermon. How could you be that pleased with me? Oh, I've seen you walk in love and humility all these years. You are a perfect expression of who I am. He hasn't done anything yet in ministry. But he is glorious in the eyes of the Father. And that's the humility as a man he walked in. That's part of his humility. That's not the whole of it. That was one facet of his humility. Of course, the other facets, he took the privileges of deity. He laid them aside for a season. He was locked into loving and serving, being true to his nature. No fanfare about him at all. Paragraph C, verse 7, Isaiah 49, verse 7. Now the Father speaks. Now the Father answers. This uneventful life of this young man in his first 30 years, the last 3.5 years, were pretty dramatic, but he said, I'm pleased with you before he even started that final 3.5 years. The Father says this must have confused Isaiah because Isaiah knows he's talking, he's hearing information, receiving information about the Messiah. Verse 7, now the Father says to Jesus, you know, Jesus, men are going to despise you. Isaiah's thinking, why would they despise him? He's the Messiah. He's God or whatever. I don't know if they knew he's God, but I don't know how much Isaiah fully grasped his own prophecies. Men will despise him, the Father tells the Son, and Isaiah, wow. He goes, well, it's worse than that. The nation of Israel will actually abhor you. They will hate you, not for 33 years only. They will hate you for 2,000 years. They will hate you. They will abhor you. Isaiah doesn't, of course, know how long it will go, but he's a little bit perplexed. But don't worry. This will not offend you. So not throw off my plan. And the Father names Jesus with one of the great titles that God ever gave Jesus in the Bible. He calls him servant of all the nations. For you are the servant of the nations. None of this will derail you. None of this will throw you off. You will stay steady and complete the task I have given to you to do the work of salvation so that one day the earth would be filled with godly, humble, loving people under my authority, connected to you, that my glory would fill the earth, my throne could come down, and love would never be diminished. I trust you, Jesus. You're the servant of the nations. You're the servant of the rulers of the earth. You will, even with all power, maintain your true identity as a servant. He says, and the kings of the earth, this is in the millennial kingdom, they will all come. They will see the princes of the earth. They will worship you. They will be awestruck with your leadership. They will want to obey you. They will give themselves to you. All the nations will admire you and completely give their hearts to you. And the Father says, because I've chosen you, I've trusted you with this whole plan, because I've seen your humility from ages past. Let's go to the very last paragraph. Paragraph G, Isaiah 66. All these passages in Isaiah. I mean, Isaiah was having quite a time grasping all of this. We'll end with this. Just one moment here. Now the Father's speaking. Heaven is my throne. Earth is my footstool. And we know that the heavenly and the earthly realm are going to be brought together on the earth. That's the Father's plan. But the Father, question of the ages. The Father says, well, I'm in the heavenly realm. I'm interacting with the earthly realm right now. I'm administrating my purposes. But here's the question of the ages. Where will my resting place be? Where will my throne rest forever in perfect agreement with the environment, with the people, with the angels? Where is the place where my throne will be undisturbed, where I will not strive with men or angels? Where will that be at? Now we know that his dwelling place will come down to the earth. We know that from Revelation 21. But here, God answers it. He says this, the place of my rest, the final chapter of the story. Of course, there's many dimensions that will happen in this. He goes, I'll be on the earth with my throne among a people who are of poor spirit and contrite heart, that are humble like my servant, my son, who brought them forth. It's humility creates the place where the humble God rests forever, meaning in perfect agreement with his people. This is the God we serve. We love him so much. He's so beautiful to us. I'm going to have the worship team come. The beautiful God, the humble God. Jesus, let's stand. Jesus, we trust you. We admire you. We long to be near you. We want to see you for who you are. Show us your humility. Let's just all close your eyes for just a moment. Just contemplate on the Lord's presence for just a minute. So no one's distracting you. Your humility, Jesus. You're so beautiful in your humility. There's none like you. Holy Spirit, show us his heart. He's the beautiful God.
You're worth it all. You're beautiful.
We would serve you again and again.
You're beautiful. You're beautiful.
Feel free to come up here if you want to worship.
Beautiful.
Remain in your chairs, whatever you want.
Worth it all.
We're just going to take a few moments and respond to the Lord.
Beautiful. You're worth it all. Beautiful.
We love your leadership, Jesus.
Giving you all there is.
Release your glory even now. servant of the nations.
Jesus, would you show us your heart?
Show us your humility.
Show us who you are.
I wanna know you right. Jesus,
Jesus, you made humility beautiful.
You made it beautiful.
You came so low.
In the form of a man you came.
You are the God who kneels. You are the God who came to wash our feet.
We love your heart, Jesus.
Thank you.